Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Following a spate of teachers' strikes in conservative red states, a Red for Ed movement is growing across the United States. Teachers are now at the forefront of labor actions in the United States. Now, a massive teachers' strike is underway in the city of Los Angeles. 30,000 teachers in Los Angeles are now on strike, impacting 600,000 students. Their demands include wage increases, reduced classroom size, more nurses and support staff in schools to serve the students. Our guest is Steve Seal, Harbor Area Chair of UTLA, the United Teachers of Los Angeles. He's a fifth grade teacher at Eshelman Avenue Elementary School in Lomita, Los Angeles. And you might not know it by watching mainstream media, which is obsessed with Donald Trump. But what some are calling a revolution is underway across France. It is called the Gilets Jaunes. When it is covered in U.S. media, it gives the impression that it is a right-wing movement. And while indeed right-wing forces are trying to infiltrate and divide the movement, nothing could be further from the truth. Indeed, it is a grassroots movement. Who are the yellow vests, the Gilets Jaunes? What do they want? What have women done in the movement? What has happened since they began their protests? What has been the impact on the Macron government of France? Is the movement growing? Our guest is Benoît Martin, who spoke with Gilets Jaunes activists on the ground in France. He is with Payday, a network of men who work with the Global Women's Strike. He has lived in Canada, France, and London, England. Also, Alan Minsky, formerly the program director of KPFK and now executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, joins us in studio to discuss the merger of PDA, the Progressive Democrats of America, with Our Revolution, which grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign and is headed by Nina Turner, president of Progressive Democrats of President of Our Revolution. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Tens of thousands of Los Angeles school teachers are walking the picket line for a second day in a strike against the nation's second largest school district. No new talks are scheduled. Ernesto Arce reports from Los Angeles.
Los Angeles Unified educators from every corner of the city staffed picket lines at over 800 schools despite the steady rainfall. It was the first LAUSD teacher strike in 30 years. Alex Caputo-Pearl, United Teachers Los Angeles president, said the district needed to fund schools and put the entire community first.
So here we are on a rainy day in the richest country in the world, in the richest state in the country, in a state as blue as it can be, and in a city rife with millionaires, where teachers have to go on strike to get the basics for our students.
LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner estimated that about 3,500 people were taking part in pickets at the schools. He urged UTLA officials to return to the bargaining table.
We remain committed to resolve the contract negotiations.
In Los Angeles, I'm Ernesto Arce, Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
The Senate Judiciary Committee is opening confirmation hearings for President Trump's Attorney General nominee, William Barr. Barr's written testimony shows he plans to tell lawmakers Trump never sought any promises, assurances, or commitments, and he didn't offer Trump any before he was nominated. Barr will say it's vitally important that Special Counsel Robert Mueller be allowed to complete his Russia probe and that he believes Congress and the public should learn the results. The remarks are intended to reassure Democratic senators troubled by Barr's past comments on the special counsel investigation, including an unsolicited memo he sent the Justice Department last year criticizing the inquiry into whether Trump had obstructed justice. Civil rights and civil liberties groups are warning about Barr's record. The Drug Policy Alliance said he's been a cheerleader for mass incarceration. The National Immigration Law Center said Barr had supported border militarization and the criminalization of migrants. The Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights said Barr's record suggests more of the anti-civil rights policies promoted by former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was ousted by President Trump. House Republicans will block Iowa Representative Steve King from serving on any committees in the new Congress as punishment for his remarks about white supremacy. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy announced the move. He denounced King's remarks as beneath the dignity of the party of Lincoln and the United States. King had served on the Agriculture, Small Business, and Judiciary Committees in the last Congress. He chaired Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution and Civil Justice. In an interview with the New York Times, King questioned how the terms white nationalism and white supremacy became offensive. The action by the Republican Steering Committee came after King and McCarthy met Monday to discuss his remarks. They were the latest in a years-long pattern of racist comments. New Utah Senator Republican Mitt Romney said King should resign.
I think there's a room for Steve King's comments in polite company or in the Republican Party or, for that matter, in Congress. I think you ought to step aside, and I think Congress ought to make it very clear he has no place there.
Since the interview, King has denied he's a racist and said his remarks were mischaracterized. A Zimbabwean military helicopter fired tear gas at demonstrators blocking a road and burning tires in the capital on a second day of deadly protests after the government more than doubled the price of fuel in the economically shattered country. Businesses, schools, and public transit were shut down. Five people were killed yesterday after security forces opened fire on crowds. Protesters said they couldn't take the fuel price hikes.
Guys here at the Market Square bus terminus, things are no longer going well. We have closed businesses and people are running all over the place. And we do not know what is really happening. And we do not even know if we can make it home.
A helicopter is roving here in Mavuku and there is something serious happening. People of Mavuku have refused to be taken for granted. Soldiers are roving in the skies with helicopters here as I am talking, and people are saying enough is enough.
The Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions has called for a three-day national shutdown to protest against the fuel price hike. British lawmakers are preparing to deliver their verdict on Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit divorce deal with the European Union after 2 years of political upheaval. Her deal faces widespread opposition. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And today is day two of the massive teachers' strike going on in Los Angeles. We are aiming to bring you daily coverage as long as the strike continues. And also, just to note that those of us here on Sojourner Truth are standing in solidarity with the teachers. Now, the figures of the teachers on strike. I've heard of 30,000 teachers, and I've also heard 32,000 that went on strike on Monday, January 14th. So today is the second day of the strike, and the teachers' union, UTLA, they are asking all teachers and supporters, parents, etc., to show a massive presence that disrupts business as usual in downtown Los Angeles. This according to a report from CNN. They're also called for Tuesday's demonstration. They are at the California Charter Schools Association, and they're asking for it to be as big or larger than Monday's walkout, which was massive. Also, this teacher's strike is the first in Los Angeles in 30 years. It is reported that one day of the strike has cost the Los Angeles School District $15 million. Let's go to a clip now from CBS on the teacher's strike. Let's go to that clip right now.
Well, some parents this morning and students are reporting chaotic conditions in Los Angeles schools as a teacher strike enters its second day. Educators in the nation's second largest school district stood in pouring rain on the picket lines yesterday. The district says fewer than 142,000 students showed up for class. That's about a quarter of the district's 600,000 students. Tony DeCopel is outside San Fernando Senior High School, north of downtown Los Angeles. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. Well, there's more rain expected today and also more picketing as those teachers demand greater resources for a predominantly low-income school district that they fear is falling behind. But in the meantime, as you point out, not a lot of learning is going on. Attendance down across the district. And at this school in particular, attendance was down 90% on Monday. Armed with ponchos and picket signs, tens of thousands of Los Angeles public school teachers took their fight to the streets Monday.
We are willing to do what it takes for our children, for our students. So if we have to be out here in the rain, that's what we're going to do. We're going to be in the rain.
It's not fair for teachers to buy supplies for their students.
Claudia Aguilera has a daughter in the fourth grade.
What brings you out to the picket line?
I'm fighting for her to have a small class.
Along with smaller class sizes, teachers are demanding higher pay and more funding for counselors and nurses. They've been working without a contract for a year and a half.
We're doing everything that we can to help these kids, and I don't think the district is doing everything they can to help us to help the kids.
While the district is keeping schools open, it wants union teachers back at work.
We urge them to resume bargaining with us anytime, anywhere. 24/7, we'd like to resolve this.
With 80% of students in the district coming from low-income families, many kids rely on school not just for education, but for daily meals. Supper was served at Atwater Avenue Elementary on Monday, but attendance was down by almost two-thirds. The kids who did show up say they spent the day reading books and doing puzzles.
It felt weird because all the classes were mixed up and sixth grade, fifth grade, and fourth grade.
When I came to school, I was like, wow, we really can't live without teachers.
I think a lot of people agree with little Giselle there. We mentioned this is a low-income school district, but there's another factor here. The UCLA Civil Rights Project points out that this district is one of the most segregated in the country, more than 70% Latino, less than 10% white students. The longer this strike drags on, the more people here will wonder if those numbers were reversed, would the money be easier to find? Nora?
It's a good point, Tony. Thank you. And you think about how many kids rely on school to get a meal. The superintendent of the LA Unified School District is writing in the Wall Street Journal today that 82% of students rely on free or reduced wage meals at school, including 72,000 special needs students. This is an emergency.
This is indeed an emergency, and the question can be raised that this really should be the national emergency that Donald Trump is talking about. But I'd like to welcome our guest, Steve Seal, Harbor Area Chair of UTLA, which is the United Teachers of Los Angeles. Steve Seal is a fifth grade teacher at Eshelman Avenue Elementary School in Lomita, Los Angeles. Steve, welcome.
Good morning.
Okay, so Steve, you heard in that clip that the school district is asking you to go back to work. Are you gonna go back to work today? Are you headed to work? What's going on?
I'm out on the strike line right now at my school, and we're staying here as long as we need to get the things we need. The district has been untruthful in terms of the money that's available, and there needs to be some movement on the class sizes. And class sizes is out of control right now. And fully funding our schools is a thing. We have one nurse here, usually one day a week most of the time. And it's just crazy.
Yeah, so you're out on the picket line right now. Now, what's the mood? I mean, we saw photos of massive, I don't know, tens of thousands of teachers that descended on downtown Los Angeles yesterday. What is the mood on the picket line where you are, the teachers at your school, Steve?
You know, it's actually pretty good. My teachers are very fired up. They're all out here with their phones right now, and we're just getting kind of started here. The kids don't show up for a little while, so we're being very visible. People are supporting us by going by and honking. We've had people drop off, you know, donuts, and different people from the Torrance District, which is right next to us, bring over some granola bars and stuff. The Kepcare workers have been helpful, bringing out coffee to us and stuff. And so we're out here for the duration, and we're planning on being here all morning, and then we're going to join up with the schools around us and be on our PCH for a little while, and then go on up to the Charter School Association headquarters for a rally today.
Right. And why the Charter School Association for today's rally?
Because the charters in LA Unified are just out of control. There's so many of them, and they're unregulated, and they're taking students away from the public schools, and it's just become out of control. The co-location issue alone, that is a state law, is just, you know, going into all these schools and bringing in dual systems. So it's just not right.
Yeah, and the other thing are the support that teachers are getting from other unions. I'm proud to say that our union, we are a union shop, SAG-AFTRA, they are supporting the strike. And indeed, they've sent out a call to all of its members to wear red and to join teachers on picket lines. And now there is a call by Teamsters Local 399, which is calling on its members to honor the teachers' picket lines. So that's going to have an impact. Yeah.
You know, we've been getting ILWU people have adopted schools in the harbor area where I am. So they're basically sending out 5 and 6 people in the morning out to a different school site. And we're also the United Steelworkers has allowed us to use one of their locations as a union hall, since we can't use the school sites anymore, to have our meetings. And the stage, you know, picking up posters and things like that. So it's actually been a really good, union solidarity thing throughout the city, as well as the ones that are in place right now. I know the SEIU 99, some of them have walked out, some haven't, but they already settled a contract. But they're out to support with us as well. Like I just said, some of the cafeteria workers are bringing us out coffee, and the aides are coming out in the morning and in the afternoon when they're done with their day. So it's been really good, and it's really energizing for people to see everybody show that kind of solidarity.
Right, and the other thing I wanted to raise with you in that clip we just heard from a CBS report, where 82% of the students in Los Angeles USD are low income, and a number of those students are depending on getting food at school because those may be their only meals. I mean, breakfast and lunch in particular, and also since desegregation, basically. Across the United States, there's been a white flight of students into private schools or into charter schools, those who can afford it. So only 10% of the school district right now white, 70% Latinx. So, a huge percentage of students of color, Latinx as well as Black students. And the reporter asked the question that if those numbers were reversed, if the school district was 70% white, right, and only 10% students of color, would the district be responding in this way? And the class sizes and the resources and the nurses and psychologists who have been denied your students, if that's the case. I just wondered your thought on the food issue and also on, you know, any thoughts on the race issue and resources.
We work at these school sites, and we're teaching our most needy students, you know, in the area. We're, you know, trying to make them believe that they can go to college and move on and give them those skills, you know. So I think you're right about the district and their thoughts around that stuff. And, schools, the students that are coming, they're getting the meals here at school. There's also been some people that have taken on to feed some of the students, especially in some of the most greatest need schools in the Central City and in East Area, have been basically getting people to give meals to the students that aren't there, that are coming into life, so they don't have to go into the school.
Right. And I understand that Atwater Elementary School and some other schools as well, that volunteers are out there, including some teachers helping to provide some food for those students. And Steve, we know that the success of the strikes that happen in some of the red states, I mean, we saw strikes in kicking off in West Virginia, of all places, and going to Arizona, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and others, that's support from the community was really vital, and the fact that the demands of the teachers also showed concerned for what was happening at the community level, and they also did their very best to provide food for the students in need. Just your final thoughts, and for people also, for people who want to support the strike, what they should do, Steve.
I think they can go adopt a school. We have 900 schools throughout the district, and there's picket lines at every single one of them. There's over 35,000 people that are out there in the street right now, out in front of schools. We're fighting for our students. We're fighting for better schools, and that's the bigger thing. It's a civil rights issue. You know, we're not really asking for money for ourselves. We're asking for money for the schools, and that's why our cause is righteous. And we're going to be out here as long as we have to be to make sure that we use some of that $1.9 billion surplus that the district is sitting on to make things right.
Right. Well, I know you are out on a picket line, Steve Seal, Harbor Area Chair of UTLA, United Teachers of Los Angeles, fifth grade teacher at Eshelman Avenue Elementary School in Lomita, Los Angeles. Steve, I'm reaching out to teachers who are listening and that who you may know, because we want to give daily coverage on this as long as this strike continues. So everybody out there, please email us at, you can email me directly at mpkpfk@gmail.com or sojournertruthradio@gmail.com. And we want to hear your stories. We want to hear your voices. And Steve Seal, all the best to you. Good luck. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We will also want to thank teacher, LAUSD teacher, Berit Jordal, for her help with today's segment. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to turn our attention to what's happening in France. You might not know it by watching the mainstream media, as I said earlier, which is obsessed with Donald Trump, but some are calling saying that a revolution is underway across France, a yellow vest movement called the Gilets Jaunes. And so who are the yellow vests? What do they want? What have women done in the movement? What has happened since they began their protests? What has been the response by the Macron government? Now, just to share a little background with you on that. Since November 2018, mass protests across France from Paris to the south have blockaded key roads and disrupted business as usual. Even the famed Eiffel Tower in Paris was shut down, and fashion houses, including Dior, were forced to cancel shows. Protests organized by the Yellow Vest movement have involved mass protests and the blocking of roads and fuel depots. Some of the protests have grown into major uprisings, described as the largest of their kind since May of 1968. That was when a student and worker-led movement in France held mass demonstrations against the government of conservative president Charles de Gaulle, who was just as unpopular as France's now president, Macron. Since the protests began in November, participation in weekly Saturday protests have been increasing. The latest round of protests held on Saturday, January 12th, brought an estimated 84,000 people across the country, according to France 24. Meanwhile, matching the numbers of the protesters, Macron's police deployed at least 80,000 security forces nationwide. He's promised a zero tolerance for any violence. The police used tear gas to disperse crowds. They've also used water cannons. In Paris, around the Arc de Triomphe, riot police fired water cannon and tear gas at protesters. They say that they were hit by stones and paint. And on Saturday, January 12th, 244 people were arrested across France. 156 of those arrests were in Paris. Overall, over 2,300 protesters have been arrested thus far, according to CNN. And since the protests began, 10 civilians have died, 1,407 have been injured, most from police brutality. Dozens of people have been seriously injured and mutilated by shootings of flashballs and grenades. So let us go now to a clip again from CNN to hear their take on the Yellow Vest movement.
In late November and early December, thousands took to the street of France in multiple protests. Hundreds injured, hundreds arrested, dozens of vehicles torched, and several shops looted. The famous Arc de Triomphe defaced.
The violence is something that we've rarely seen to this level. You'd have to go back to 68, I think, to see the same or similar kinds of scenes of these street blockades, the burning cars, the paving stones being thrown at the police using tear gas with abandon.
It's a situation that is really very tense.
Jim Bitterman has reported from the French capital for almost 40 years.
It is a very, at least potentially dangerous situation as the movement spreads and as there increasingly is a vagueness about what it is exactly that could bring it to an end.
The protesters, who call themselves Gilets Jaunes, or Yellow Vests, are part of a grassroots citizens movement that began over rising fuel prices and eco-taxes that were set to come into effect in January.
You have to have a yellow vest, it's required by law, in your car. Every motorist has to have one of these in his car. So anybody can join this movement without any kind of thought.
From there, the unrest turned into a broader demonstration against French President Emmanuel Macron and his policies.
Once you get an uprising that's spread across the country the way this one has and kind of captured the imagination of people who might not have even thought about protesting the fact that the cost of living is so high or that the pensions haven't gone up, where you get people saying, well, that affects me too, and maybe I should get out there.
The unrest also spread to hundreds of high schools across France, where students have been demonstrating against the government's recent education reforms. But among the protesters are also anarchists, elements of the anti-immigration populists and hardcore fascists.
It's pretty difficult to generalize about exactly who they are. The first elements of this were bent on just raising trouble, creating mayhem, and that sort of thing. Now, though, I think there are a number of other people that have joined in.
After days of unrest, President Macron announced that the fuel taxes planned for January would not be introduced in 2019. But the movement was already about more than just taxes. And it may take even more to avoid further chaos.
All right, there you go. I'd like to welcome our guest, Benoit Martin. Benoit was in the south of France in December, meeting with the Yellow Vest, or the Gilets Jaunes. He is a member of Payday, a network of men working with the Global Women's Strike. He has followed very, very closely the development of this movement. Benoit himself, he's lived in France, Canada, as well as the UK. Benoit, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, so Benoit, in that clip, you heard the piece saying that, well, the Gilets Jaunes are, you know, part of them are right-wingers. Now, it's surprising how many people I mention this movement to, even among progressive people in the United States, and they say, yeah, but, you know, isn't it a right-wing movement? So the kind of propaganda being put out on mainstream media in the U.S. Sadly is having an impact, but we need to set them straight, Benoit.
That's right. The Gilets Jaunes, as the clip explained, started by a protest against the cost of fuel. People in France is a very decentralized country. There's a lot of small town and small cities. So two-thirds of the people who go to work have, in fact, to go outside their town to work. That means because the transport is no good, they have to take their car. So for them, the fuel was quite a key issue. And a lot of the Gilets Jaunes, you know, would spend something like $200 or $250, for example, a month, which is a lot of money when the minimum wage is about $1,200. You know, when you're spending a quarter or a fifth of your income, that's quite important. So a lot of the Gilets Jaunes, in fact, are people who, at the beginning, at the very least, were people who were earning a little wage, often had to use their car, but also pensioner and other people. Some study says that the average age is 45 years old. So, you know, it's that kind of class, if you like, have been involved. Now, a lot of people who were involved in the struggle were first-timer protesters. we heard that over and over again, not only those who organized the blockades, but those who participated in it, were that was their first demonstration. So this is not, if you like, the typical left-wing activist and so on. Obviously, some right-wing group have been trying to use that movement to their own purpose. But by and large, I think it's fair to say that the Gilets Jaunes have always rejected any political party. They don't want to be associated with political party. They have their own demand, which is really about economic justice. As the clip, I think, was telling us, you know, people are not now only demanding to scrap the cost of the fuel, but they want economic justice. They see that the 500 richest people in France are earning three times as much as they were 10 years ago after the so-called financial crash. And that's really infuriating. And that's what has fueled that movement, who are really repeatedly demanding justice. The movement, we heard in the clip,
I just wanted to share, too, to underscore that point on who this movement is. Mm-hmm. There's the yellow vest of Montreuil. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Montreuil.
Mm-hmm. Montreuil. Yeah, they say, and I'm quoting this, this is... they said, neither skin color, birthplace, gender, sexual orientation, nor religion will be used as a pretext to divide us. We must be united in our differences if we want to build a more just and beautiful world. In Iraq, Tunisia, Belgium, Kurdistan, Syria, Japan, Hungary, Spain, Burkina Faso, Egypt, England, Morocco, Italy, and in many other places, people wear yellow vests to show their anger. Our revolt has no border. And they also say that it's the beginning of a revolution that aims to build a more dignified and just society. And they will not stop even if it takes 100 years. So they're planning for a long haul struggle here, Benoit. So that statement certainly isn't the voice of right wingers. So who are the people in the movement? And in particular, tell us about the role of women as well as students. I see that mothers have formed a union and have made a very strong statement, including against police brutality against their children. Benoit.
That's right. Well, it's worth noting that the person who initiated way back last summer a petition against the fuel increase was a black woman in France from Martinique, from apparently from Martinique, and she's called Patricia Ludowski. So that's already something to note.
Yeah.
But more broadly, you have to understand when the Gilets Jaunes started to organize around the motorway and blocking the entry to the motorway and so on, the women were there in the first place to communicate with the motorists. There's been a whole set of organizing and communication with the motorists while they were prevented to travel, if you like. People were talking in the runabout, in the exits, and so on. So their demand, their anger, what they wanted, there was a whole discussion going on. And in fact, I think certainly the big media, if you like, being against that movement, they have used that one-to-one, if you like, communication and discussion to really spread their message and their support. Today, we have polled that said that 71% of the French population support the Gilets Jaunes.
Wow.
So that's quite something, and that's why the government is in trouble. They can't isolate them as a single violent crowd, which they're trying to portray. But back to the role of women, it's true that after the Gilets Jaunes really initiated this movement, and they're not only protesting every weekend, it is really a daily protest. When I was there in France, you could see still in the roundabout, group of Gilets Jaunes, they are there every day. They are there every day. Sometimes they block the circulation. Sometimes they let people go. Sometimes they let people go for free. You know, you have to pay money to go on the motorway, but they let them go free. The old speed camera, for example, on the motorway are now being put out of order by the Gilets Jaunes so that the state cannot pocket money out of this kind of scheme.
Wow.
So the women have been also very much in the forefront of opposing police violence. That was true when, especially when the young people, the students in colleges, maybe you've seen some images, shocking images, where hundreds of students in a college were put on their knees with their hand behind their head by the police, supposedly because there was some violence going on. I think there was a bin that was put into fire, that kind of thing. But there was a lot of racism, and the mothers stood up, create that organization of mothers saying, we are here to defend our children. We don't want them to be brutalized. We want them to have a future. And for children to have your future is a big, big motivation of the yellow vest. You hear that all the time. And that's definitely because of the caring work that women, and to some extent men, do for their children that makes them resist so much. And they're not ready to give up.
Right. And Benoit, tell us about what is happening in the town of Commercy, because there's supposed to be a national meeting of the movement happening there. What is the importance of this meeting?
Well, the group, now what's happening is that the Gilets Jaunes have started to organize city by city, town by town. Commercy is a small town in the northeast of France of about 6,000 people, but people have been organizing ever since there. They built a little shed in the center of the town where they meet every day, where they have regular general assembly, and they discuss that a way to build a national movement was to call for other people to do the same. So in December, they call for all the Gilets Jaunes to organize and have their own general meeting so that local people can have a place to go and discuss and make decisions. Now, they've made a call for a national meeting, which will take place in their town of Commercy on the 26th of January, with delegates of all these local general meeting, if you like, which they call popular assembly. That's quite important because the government have tried to identify leaders or representatives to negotiate with. And the Commercy people, and in fact, it seems that most of the Gilets Jaunes throughout the country not only reject political party, but they also reject having a representative so far. And you have seen some people who were kind of opportunists and say, well, I can speak for the movement. And really, they were prevented by the people, by the mass of people, say, no, you're not to talk in our name. The government, says the people in Commercy, they know what we want. We want, you know, economic justice. We also want reform. They want to change the way the political system work. For start, they want the president to resign. That's
right.
Very important.
Really, really
but
important.
They also want to change, you know, the way politics is done. In France, the president, and maybe that's the case in the U.S., he has a lot of power. And they want that to change.
Right. Benoit, we are running a little short of time here. We see that the French President Emmanuel Macron, he's launching a grand debate to try to appease the yellow vest movement. But I just want to play a little bit of the determination of the protests you could hear in this sound, and then the shots you hear in the background of likely some kind of projectile fired by police. Let's go to that clip now.
Je m'appelle Rosalie, j'appartiens à Sudpost 92. J'ai 60 ans, ça fait 30 ans que je suis à la poste. Et je suis en grève depuis le 26 mars contre le licenciement de notre représentant syndical Gaël Quirante.
Gouvernement, c'est dégueulasse.
Avec ça, on a agrégé toutes les revendications de la condition de travail qui sont la suppression
All righty. And that one, actually, we didn't hear the sound I was hoping to give our listeners. But Benoit, just final thoughts from you, because you could hear, though, the determination and the fact that this has been going on for so long, practically a daily struggle. I mean, France hasn't seen anything like this since 1968. And I read an article this morning that the Yellow Vest movement is now spreading to Canada. And of course, there are people who are trying to exploit, put on yellow vests and could, you know, say they stand for any old right wing stuff. But people are also calling them out. Just a quick final thought, Benoit.
The same is true where I'm calling from in London. There was a big march calling for a general election this Saturday, and you have a lot of people wearing yellow vests. There was some French yellow vests who spoke also at the rally and so on. I think what's the key thing for me is that people have organized by themselves and for themselves. And that meeting on the 26th hopefully will strengthen that position. People have had enough of the division that often political party create.
Right. We are going to have to leave it there. Benoit Martin, who is with Payday Men's Network that worked with the Global Women's Strike. Benoit, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we hope to hear more about the Yellow Vest movement. We're going to take a short station break now. And coming up, Alan Minsky, waiting in the wings in studio, talking about a strategic partnership. It's not a merger. It's a strategic partnership between Progressive Democrats of America and our revolution. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Gloria Steinem.
This is Joni Mitchell.
This is Brother Cornel West. And you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
All righty. And there in the background, you hear the Yellow Vest, the Gilets Jaunes, making some music at one of their protests on the ground in France. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And on Instagram and Twitter, our handle is @SoTrueRadio. And we also want to give a shout out to our listeners on SoundCloud. Look for us on SoundCloud, where all of our shows, by the way, are archived. So topics that you missed, you can find them out. And in our tradition, we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Jamaica, New York City today. And internationally, we want to give a shout out to our listeners across France. Yes, we do have listeners across France of Sojourner Truth. And now I'm delighted to welcome in studio Alan Minsky, known to many of you listening right now. He served as the program or interim program director for many years at KPFK. But a lot of people don't know a lot about Alan. I don't have a full bio of Alan, but I do know he's a Yale grad. I do know that he is not only a movement person, but he's also an intellectual. I mean, he gives incredibly sharp analysis and, is very valuable, an independent thinker, as a friend of mine would say. And he is now the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. And they have announced and established a strategic partnership with our revolution. Of course, our revolution, headed by Nina Turner, came out of the Bernie campaign and that movement. Alan, welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. Margaret Prescott, this is one of the great radio shows in the world.
Why, thank you for that. I didn't pay him. I didn't ask him to say that. But Alan, before we talk about this strategic partnership, look at the times we're in right now. Mm-hmm. We just did the segment of this growing mass movement in France, the Yellow Vest. Haven't seen anything like it since 1968. Massive teachers strike going on here and going on in Southern California and Los Angeles. Then, of course, there's the government shutdown today, a key vote in the UK on Brexit. I just wondered your thoughts about the times that we are in right now.
Well, I'd be remiss if I first didn't say that PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, are in full solidarity with the teachers strike here in Los Angeles. I will be out on the picket lines later today. Well, yes, it's incredibly complex times. And I know even this to touch on the fact that you mentioned that there are solidarity yellow jackets up in Canada. At the same time as that is happening, people may not know that in the province of Ontario, they are having one of the most reactionary privatization neoliberal pushes from the brother of the former mayor of Toronto. You think the whole family would be disgraced, the Ford brother. And it is one of the most right-wing, and also he sort of is positioning himself as the Canadian Trump. So this is going on all over the place. You have the rise of this authority.
And Brazil, boy.
Whew. Mm-hmm. You have the rise of this authoritarian, anti-democratic, small d, democratic right. And you have the rise also at the same time of people who are critiquing neoliberal capitalism, the globally dominant economic system of the past few decades. People are fed up with it. They see that basically all of the work that everybody does in society, you know, people scrape and they work four jobs and they might be able to get by overworking, and all the profits, everybody in the world sees this, all the profits go to the very few at the top. And people are tired of that. So it's a period of incredible contestation. Of course, the move to the right, more often than not, is infused with a ethno-nationalist racist component. And so
anti-immigrant, yeah.
Anti-immigrant, for sure. And so, you know, we on the left believe that we have a vision of social organization that will be more benevolent. It will be better for the planet. It will be better for the average person. It will be better for the vast majority of people. In fact, it will even be better, certainly, as you climb up the class ladder all the way through, you know, the upper middle class. Only the very top maybe will see their lives change, because they can't live a life that's entirely about, you know, luxury and luxury commodities that they just, you know, bathe in every day. So we can organize society in a much more beneficial way. And Progressive Democrats of America is an organization. It's only as old as 2004, but again, the political spectrum has changed so dramatically in recent years in the United States. You have it's really sort of hard to think back to 2004. Don't forget, you would have been at that point through a number of election cycles where nothing outside of the neoliberal center was gaining any traction inside the Democratic Party. And I think I can't put my put myself inside the minds of the people who started PDA, but it came out of the 2004 election cycle. And I think that John Kerry was somebody who a lot of people thought had a good amount of progressive cred. And he ran this incredibly conservative campaign, if you remember.
Yep.
You know, he tried to say, like, I'm the military guy, and I can, you know, and not only that, it was so politically tone deaf. But out of 2004, PDA.
Weren't we both at the convention, Democratic convention?
Yeah, yeah.
2004?
In Boston, yeah.
Right.
I was inside and outside, and you're always inside and outside. And PDA is inside and outside. It was established to be an organization that provided a conduit for radical activism to have a voice inside the halls of political power. But it was specifically designed to try to gain influence inside the Democratic Party for the pragmatic, even say reality, that, you know, in the United States of America, we effectively live in a two-party system. And if it's the only game in town, we've got to win the game. And that's what PDA was founded upon. And, you know, to create a way in which, you know, grassroots activism and the voice of people in communities can be heard inside the party, and also to try to take over the party. Now, fast forward 14 years, and yeah, you have Democratic Socialists running inside the Democratic Party. So it's safe to say that the people who did build this up, they had a vision that's caught on. Now, PDA doesn't deserve all the credit by any measure. It's been an incredibly important player in that process, maybe as important as any institution in that process. But now in 2018, we see clearly that if you're a person who considers yourself on the left, a political radical, a political left progressive, a political left liberal, PDA is an institution to get involved in, but also to fight the fight inside the Democratic Party. That's going on right now, and I think everybody can see that clear as day when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is perhaps the second most followed political figure in the country. And the only reason that someone has more of a following is because they're occupying 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue right now.
That's right. And of course, PDA, you know, the whole Run Bernie Run campaign had a big impact on Bernie Sanders running. And I really think that if Bernie had been the nominee, I think he would have beat Trump, even with all of the disinformation and the theft of votes and repression of votes, you know, et cetera. And I really think it was a mistake for Bernie not to have been chosen. And now, of course, there's a lot of speculation about whether or not he will run. But tell us what does, you know, a little bit about our revolution, and what does this strategic partnership mean? What is the significance of the strategic partnership between our revolution and progressive Democrats?
Well, I think it's a very – first of all, it's a thing where there are a number of new organizations that we are friendly with and supportive of. There are a number of new organizations on the scene. For instance, there's DSA. PDA has traditionally had a very strong and positive relationship
with DSA.
Tell us what DSA. Sorry, Democratic Socialists of America. Now, there are two other very large federal PACs. PDA is, in its official structure, a federal PAC, which is an important component when you think about why a partnership with Our Revolution. I'll get to that in a minute. But there are other organizations like Democracy for America. I'm going to get the name wrong, but it's CPCC is another one which traditionally has been the backbone of Elizabeth Warren's support, both in Massachusetts and around the country. And those organizations, we're friends with them. I'm not going to say anything negative about them, but they are specifically not mass membership organizations in which their supporters, donors, and activists have chapter meetings around the country in which they have direct civic engagement with their federally elected officials. That's the model of PDA. It's a very quirky and hybrid structure. We are a federal PAC. Now, we have a sibling organization that is an official lobbying organization led by the great Andrea Miller, and it's called People Demanding Action, PDA, you get it, and we're Progressive Democrats of America. We are a federal PAC, and they are a lobbying group. And we sort of hit the gavel and say, now our People Demanding Action section of the meeting is happening, and this is what we're going to be lobbying on. Well, PDA has local chapter meetings across the country, and the idea is we have direct, it's classic civic involvement. We are going to be developing relationships with the staff of the federal officers, the senators, and the congresspeople, as well as the officers themselves, the elected officials. And we through People Demanding Action, we do letter drops. We let them know what we support. We ask for their support on bills. And we check to see who's naughty or nice. And then, you know, if people want to run against, let's say, right-wing Democrats, we are open to, you know, speaking to candidates who challenge them. And very often we support candidates who are challenging sitting Democratic elected officials. And, of course, we try to have progressives run in seats that are held by Republicans. Now, in a number of states, we now have local PACs as well, including California. That is called PDACA.
Okay.
PDACA. Now, but here's the thing. As a federal PAC, Our Revolution has come into the game and has been very specifically focused upon building the bench of progressive candidates. So PDA is a federal PAC, and they have they endorsed a slew of people across the country running for every kind of elected official possible, including in California. And so right there, there's a natural partnership because they're building the base
right.
of the Democratic Party, the bench, as it's called, which progressives and leftists really need inside the Democratic Party.
And a progressive base.
Right, very much so. And again, we are a federal PAC, and we do all the federal lobbying, and we're very focused on the operations inside the party as well. And PDA, PDA people and supporters and activists have been a huge wedge. It's, for an example, in California recently and ongoing, there are these things called the ADEM elections. And you have like the chair of the former chair of the California Progressive Caucus, Mike Thaler, is the head now of PDACA. And Karen Bernal, the current head of the Progressive Caucus of the California Democratic Party, is a great ally of PDA.
Okay.
In states around the country, the Progressive Caucus, those are like PDA people.
Right. And of course, on the PDA board include Keith Ellison, Barbara Lee, also Lila Garrett, our very own Lila Garrett, Tom Hartman, the attorney, and Professor Marjorie Cohn, and Barbara Lee, and others. But Alan, I just in terms of you're looking forward to 2020, a lot of people are assessing what the heck happened in Florida.
Right.
Remaining a red state. Of course, part of the problem we understood was that only 18% of the black voters turned out to vote in Florida. 1/8. Okay, that's a problem. Also, and I heard this from Zahara Simmons, who is very active in the Gillum campaign in Florida. She is a former SNCCR, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and she was really almost brokenhearted at that. But also there's a problem in terms of the Latinx vote, because the analysis is that the party itself didn't really pay attention, came too late in terms of the Latinx vote, but likely also the black vote. And I'm wondering if, in terms of the role progressive Democrats of America, as well as our revolution, could really play to push the mainstream of the party to realize that they just can't take voters of color for granted, but they really have to do the groundwork.
Well, that's a big question. Of course, you're absolutely right. That's a stunning number that you cite from Florida. And again, the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And, you know, we see it right now here in Southern California. You know, who really believes that the neoliberal centrist Democrats support the striking teachers here in California? They've been behind in the last decade, the growth of the charter school movement. And again, on so many fronts, they never, you know, the mainstream of the Democratic Party never really exposed the incredible degree of voter suppression that goes around in the country. I mean, again, they are maybe big D Democrats, but they're not small D Democrats, and they haven't been involved in getting communities of color out to the ballot box, really are. And it's because they're largely corporatists. They're largely invested in drawing in support from Silicon Valley and the financial industries. And what we need is a Democratic Party that is actually a party of the people and for the people, all the people, to get everybody to vote. We certainly support the thing that's in H.R. 1 right now that has universal voter registration. And if that doesn't become law in the near future, it is a top priority for it to become law everywhere. And absolutely, we need to be in every community. We need to present a powerful, progressive, and radical vision of social transformation that improves the lives of everybody and gets everybody enthusiastic about voting inside the American Democratic
Party. Okay, so Alan Minsky, we are out of time, but and I'm going to give you a cough drop here.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. But we don't hear you enough on these airwaves, and I really want to lure you back mm-hmm. to be more on Sojourner Truth.
Love
because we really need that kind of analysis and vision, and to know what progressives are doing within a mainstream, mm-hmm. Seen to be a mainstream political party, Progressive Democrats of America, my friend Mimi Kennedy and others, strong supporters of that. So we appreciate you taking time from your childcare duties to be with us today, Alan Minsky. And we look forward to the impact that you're now going to have, much broader than KPFK and Pacifica, but in national politics generally. Alan Minsky, thank you.
And everybody out there, all PDAers, listen to Sojourner Truth.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our board op, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our assistant producer, Ramiro Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth, we'll be back on the air tomorrow with more on the teachers' strike, by the way. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We'll be right back.